Radio Verte presents Ahuga by Corey Zimmerman.
Smokey Joe, Act 4. Scum, Commander Remington told the Chicago Tribune, like the froth of gutter water floating on top of the exposed vats. Filth covered the floor, and the place was filthy with the stench of mold and refuse. Now, this beer sells for 65 cents a bottle in Southside saloons. We found more than 50 tanks of it in an abandoned warehouse, tanks once filled with dead pigs. We arrested one man who said he had been hired to take the scum off the beer. In only his first 4 years, the Tribune read, Commander Remington has amassed an impressive record. Between July 1921 and April 1925, Remington has conducted more than 15,000 raids and arrested over 18,000 people. Like other large cities with significant working class and immigrant populations who resent prohibition, Chicago is a city of copper-plated gullets, a wet city. And if there is one thing that mixes well with bathtub gin and scum beer, it's a proper head of jazz. And in Rosemary's Mystery Room, the band plays on, trying to chase the blues away. Diminished. I tend to my own gutlet, feet worn out from running barrels all day, though it's always night in the tunnels, in this underworld I dwell. I haven't written a word in some weeks now, and I'm in the joint by 11 every night, before the crowd show, and I stay until 6, long after the last patron has stumbled on home. I keep waiting, hoping to see Betty. I can't eat. I can't sleep. I can't stop drinking bathtub gin. I need her. I need to feel her, her heart pounding into mine. To feel my frailty is to know I am alive. I know. And to fear the sharpness of her blade, the way her words sliced right through me, opens my voice, my heart, and I lose all inhibition, not only to spill out those words before her on the floor, but the pages. I'm stuck, blocked, a spiraling whirlpool, spinning around, going near forth, nor up, nor down. Just here. Here in this chair. Remembering those days. Remembering those days she tried and failed to conceal herself from the world. That mask she wears, coming right off on my pillow. And as my eyes adjust to the spotlight, I see the silhouette of her delicacy, her godliness, burnt deeply into my retina. A girl, so vulnerable, so pure, so sweet, at mercy, so pure. A trust that had been laid into me, laid at my feet. And she spoke such blinding truth, one which she herself ran from daily, from every waking moment of her tragic life, those nights we shared, those nights we shivered, those words we spoke, and now I am at a loss. Now I see how utterly vulnerable I am without her, without that game that had swept away our souls, as though I'd known her for all time, a girl, the girl, an angel crooked on her nail. Or maybe I'm thinking magically. How far off am I? She spins within me while she is far off in the arms of luxury, a wealth I will never know again, nor be able to provide anyone. She possesses me like a gown, a Chinese pug drooling on the balcony, overlooking all that is golden, all that is blue. She has already forgotten me. again and again, perhaps if I call out her name into the celestial heavens, where I hope my voice will not haunt, but echo past the loftier things that now surround her. Or perhaps she will hear my moaning back up out of the sewer drain, where I mold down here in the dank underground, where she has left me. As the growing crowd applauds, the rats squeal under my heels, as she lavishes grand dinner parties celebrated by all. I roll barrels about the sewers, barrels holding the booze that pours and spills out, loosening their lips and wallets alike, producing bill notes that pay her way through life. Fuck! Who am I? Who am I anyway? As I wallow, she awakens in golden threads, and as I molt, a fresh breeze through her French doors at dawn. I wilt in stagnation. I stank. Surely she has forgotten me. Indeed, there is no reason to hold on to the nights we shared. But hell, the way she unbuttoned that corset her heart hides within, a heart that peered out of her chest right at me, out at me with a beat of blood, soft flesh, milk and honey sweet. And what did I see in such blinding light? And what did I hear in each dreadful ahuga on the street? Not a woman, but a girl. A simple little girl who confounds me and drives me mad with her raven eyes that glow like lanterns in the night. She watches me. She never lets me be, always in the corner of my eye. So mad I must drink. After all, the quartet is now in full swing. And four fingers in, I swear, I hear a cowbell. Interior voice. Oscar, Oscar, man overboard. I try to catch my bearing, eyes darting around as Rosemary's eyes dart toward Louis, who is distracted in conversation with a cat named James. You take one bottle, you see. One pint bottle of good old rye whiskey, says James. And what you do is, you add some grain alcohol, water, caramel, and some spice, some salt and pepper. And that one pint is turned into five. Yes, a cowbell. By a string running up through the floor to the ogre behind the counter in the candy shop above. He's yanking on it like hell as the squad cars line up out front. Exterior voice. Bacon! Shouts Rosemary. And Louie places a beam across the door as she hastily opens the half-door side stage, giving young Maggie a sobering shove out. Great. The half-door clogs, and I look over at Louie, the weight of his stick back against the door. With a clomping approach, a battering ram suddenly ravages the frame of his body, plowing into the steel from where Commander Remington leads his vice squad. Dark tunnels. Folks scamper every which way in a panic, trampling over each other, rats underfoot, tails trying to flee up walls, evening gowns and three-piece suits, knee-high in sewer swamp and shit. The quartet nonchalantly packs their axes, the tools of their trade, trying not to get too ruffled. They are well accustomed to their line of work, after all, and hardly flinch as the door is busted down, and Louis is thrown to the floor and topped with bacon. Rosemary stands on her throne, shouting holy hell, as a tall shelf of bottles is dumped over at the hand of a copper, and I hear glass crash and shatter as I dive into the darkness. Have you heard the cry of pain? Seeing I know these tunnels like the back of my hand, one would think I have the advantage, but the cops slosh through sewer and shit like rats, and they are on my heels in no time. I expect a baton to the back of the head any moment. My shadow before me sharpening as their lamp quickens. But I know of a rickety old ladder just ahead in a small chute just off to the left that leads to a trapdoor on the street above. I climb like hell, slipping and sliding, kick open the door and fall out of a wall to the curb. Passersby startle, already cowering in the rain. I hear the clamoring of cops on iron just below, so I stagger to my feet and make a mad dash to a church just across the way, where through blurred eyes and soggy bangs, I throw open the doors and lunge myself inside. Here I stand, soaking wet and smelling of sewer piss, trying to catch a stale breath, now fleeting. A congregation turns toward me in a sudden deadened silence. No one says a word or asks anything of me. Almost as though I had been expected, a tall black woman in a long, flowing gown parts the congregation, making her way right for me. The man of the hour, so to speak, coated in a good filth of gin, adrenaline, and fear. She closes the doors behind me, then grasps each of my hands in her own. She smiles, her warm eyes into mine, and I do not resist as she drags me forcefully into the mix with inhumane strength and shoves me to the floor, where I drop like a bag of potatoes, the congregation hurtling around me. And as I stare up wide-eyed, they encircle me on all sides, and she throws an arm up. Praise Jesus! And just like that, myself at their feet, they continue their hymning, swallowing me whole in their damp cotton gowns as the doors fly wide open yet again. And again, the congregation goes silent, turning as one body for the door. Before them, backlit by the street, two out-of-breath coppers standing just out of the rain, heels soggy on the floor, stinking of Chicago's finest, and all eyes laid upon them, the tall woman in white, eyes wide and shining, spreads her arm wide and pronounces boldly, "Welcome to the Temple of the Innocent Blood." The officers scan the congregation of black faces with a mixture of emotion, condemnation and disgust, but mostly distrust, as they step forth to look about, presumptively, for me. "That's right, join us," she says. "Everyone is welcome in the house of God." The cops force their way through the motley crew, scoffing, shoving, dividing, peering, trying to sniff me out. "If you're looking for God, you're in the right place," she says, as the taller of the two squat officers stop to stare her down, and she right back at him. And after a long, contested beat, he turns away. "Go with God now," she says, shutting the door behind them. Walking back up the aisle with brisk intent, long white, silken gown flowing by in her wake, it is stifling hot in this human cocoon. I am helped to my feet and a wave of fresh air rushes upon me with the revibrance of their hymn. Woman in all white, back before them on a small stage, recommences the candle ceremony I had so rudely interrupted. But I look around at a room unshaken, a pacific intimacy, in a room suddenly shrunken, abruptly smaller than before, no longer resembling a church at all. Rather, a small block building, something more akin to an abandoned dry goods store than the humble basilica I had spotted from the street. But oddly enough, the crowd of a dozen or so has multiplied in my vision to at least 100. Their forceful yet meek presence filling every breath of space between four walls, littered from floor to ceiling with cockeyed images of Christ. The hymn now resembles a flickering chant about altars of candles that burn a bit too bright, candlesticks looking as if they had burnt for all time. Crush. An old man pounds on a creaky piano in the left front corner, hunched over, arthritic hands resembling stones, nails, ivory, and yellowed. The notes he plays are nonsensical, the rhythm an erratic heartbeat with a confused tribal core, and standing in front of the altar is a small teepee made of thin stakes, with sticks of incense burning at its base. The tall woman in white leads a chant, a cappella punctuated by trombone bursts of glee. She makes a brief statement, yet one that sits me back and crosses my eyes, as she holds her hand right toward me. In my vision, at least, everyone appears somewhat weary at my sight, and as they still and stir in place, "And so we welcome our Smokey Joe celebrator tonight," she announces to my perplexity. "Dig." A young girl wraps a flowing white cloth about my shoulders from behind, 13 or so. She walks to the front of the room to stand before the mysterious woman who has summoned me forth. The young girl with dark hair and braids, eyebrows slanted and thick, eyes piercing jet black. They speak to me, and she speaks of me, to me. "Mother Leafy Green, I welcome our great Smokey Joe celebrator." The young girl bows, and the congregation as a whole repeats the same as I am lifted under the arms. I feel afloat as I float to the front, hook in my chest, pulling me forth with her eyes. "We come tonight to speak of a great warrior," says Leafy, as I am positioned beside her. "The great chief Smokey Joe, and all of us know how Smokey will come to our aid. He will fight your battles if you just be still." Thunder rumbles, and the tiny chapel is electrified by the sparkling dark eyes shining on me. Rain pounds the roof like cannonball as the lights flicker on and off, those eyes reflecting the candlelight. A forest of wolves, a pasture of sheep, before their pastor Leafy Green, white gown glowing in the flickering upon the altar. "Remember, Smokey Joe will help you," she shouts. "He's here to use his powers to light the way. We call to him, we pray to him, we tell him what we need." I stand awkward, confused, yet somehow calm, recollected, and subdued by the tone of her voice. And I'm hardly startled nor surprised as the doors fly open once again. Only this time, there is no one there, only volleys of rain. Until out of the blackness steps a man. He stands dazed, lightning flash silhouetting his hollowed form. He takes one long stride inward and becomes human, wobbling in place, left foot right, just inching inside the door, just enough as a gust of wind slams the door shut on his heels. His eyes glow red as coals in the dark room until the lights suddenly flicker back on, and now a rather dull gray. Disheveled, he continues to squirm in his skin. Leafy holds out a hand. "Here, we welcome all our people." She pauses momentarily, placing her hand on the altar, saying, "We pray for those behind bars of steel and shackles of the mind and soul. We offer counsel and friendship to those in the night." "It's raining hard, y'all," blurts out the newcomer as he takes a seat on an empty bench against the wall in the back. The rain continues drumming on the roof, and I notice a statue of a familiar man on the altar just behind the teepee. A rosy-cheeked man in a black suit with a red bow tie, dark sunglasses, a thick mustache, and a round bulbous nose under a feathered war bonnet. As incense curls, Leafy produces a cigar and lights it with a candle. With full cheeks, she puffs until the smoke is thick and the end of the cigar is cherry red. The air is now tobacco sweet as she plugs the gordo right into the side of the rosy-cheeked man's shit-eating grin, wafting herself in the plume of smoke, saying, "We believe in the spirits, and we know the spirits will come if we call them. And this is a special night to honor and pay our respects to Smokey Joe." "Yes, Lo," as Leafy paces back and forth across the floor before me. "The name Beatrice comes to me," she says. "Beatrice? Who is Beatrice?" she asks. "That's my mom's name," says the disheveled man on the bench in the back. "My mom's name, Beatrice." "Yeah, and your mama worried about you," says Leafy, pacing the floor more intently, seemingly heated. "She knows you out in the streets, and all kinds of things can happen," she shouts crossly. "Look at you. You know your mama worried." "Beatrice is grieving." The man stands and says, "I want to testify." "No," shouts Leafy. "You can do that later." And the man drops down on the bench. Laying her hand on my shoulder, Leafy says, "And we know from Smokey Joe that we have to be careful about money and love. We have to use money carefully. Can't waste money. Can't waste love." Leafy faces me. "I know you've been worried about money, and you need love. Yes, Lord, you need love," she says with a nod. "All right now," she says, crossing the stage. "The money is coming, but I'm afraid you have to wait for the love. But the money is coming. Now, when the money does come, when it comes, no matter how much you need that money, you leave it in your pocket, you hear? And you wait 3 days before you spend it." She warns as she turns toward me, eye gleaming into mine. She walks off stage and into the crowd, addressing individuals who shout,
"My son got in trouble. He had to go to the courthouse,"
crying out,
"I pray to Smokey Joe and tell him that they don't put him in jail."
Leafy tells the people to be patient, not to worry about the relative who is sick or the one who is so close to you yet oh so far away. and it is clear that her prophecies are not the stuff of miracles. As a folk preacher, it is evident that she knows most of the people here. Calling them by name, in a small and poor congregation, her advice on love and coping with financial stress is universally applied and consistent. But the way she faces the people and the personal address in each of her accounts elevates her general line of oratory into something more specific and at the same time, appealing. Her sway over her faction is total. Mother Leafy Green radiates confidence, and in a room of true believers, who am I to doubt the power of her ministry? As for Leafy, well, if she doesn't know the strange spellbound boy off the street, perhaps she has something of a gift, I wonder. As faith most certainly is, I realize. And as the ceremony rolls on, I stand amongst the congregation, now 200-fold, I shit you not, who chant,
Smokey Joe's a watchman. Smokey Joe's a watchman.
He will fight your battles. In solidarity of a common struggle. Within the presence of Smokey Joe, Leafy dances across the floor, chanting, kneeling before the teepee, calling out his name. And as the ceremony reaches a lull, Leafy, back on her feet, continues pacing the floor, shouting,
Now I ain't gonna call any names, but there's money in this room, big money. And the important thing about the money is it's gotta be used right.
Incense and Tobacco Sweden, the old man at the old piano, thumps the keys repeatedly with his giant knuckled fists. A calamity, Leafy begins chanting softly, and in the middle of this chaos, she stops and points directly at me once more, commanding, If you want to know Smokey, then you must come to the altar once more. And you, and you, and you, she says, pointing from one face to the next. Coda. With each soul, I approach the altar, with the hundreds nearing 1,000 packed in the small room, now expanding as large as a great cathedral, as Leafy produces a bottle of liquor, takes a swig, and dances about. And swept away, we join her, clapping in rhythm with our feet, chanting,
Makate Mishe Kiak Yak, Makate Mishe Kiak Yak, Makate Mishe Kiak Yak.
All the while, Smokey chews on his cigar, as Leafy spits a mist of liquor in his face, as the rain pours down from heaven above, as the drops drum the roof, as the thunder rolls through the mysterious night. As I cry, as I drop my eyes down to my side, as I see her deep slanted brow and her doe eyes reflecting the darkness of my soul back at itself.
I see you, she says.